2003, and members and guests are going to look at a little different order of our agenda than what you see in print. We will first take up Senate Bill 233, and then SJM 3, then SJM 5, be about 1:30. And then House Bill 2813, we have had a couple of different amendments that are being proposed by the proponent. She is not here at this time, and although she had expected to be back at some point within this next 2 hours, it's my understanding that these amendments have substantially changed the bill, and without getting a little bit more discussion, I think, with some people, we just didn't want to even bring it out as a work session, since that's all we've scheduled for the hearing, because I think we will need to have more public hearing time on that. So, you know, it's one of those things that we're trying to still make sure we get some things down and settled on that bill before we move it out, and at the request of the proponent, the legislator, we are just going to hold this off and see when we can reschedule it again shortly, either next Tuesday or the following Thursday. So, with that then, let's go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 233, and John Schultz. Oh, and Jerry Madigan.
They gave me. They gave me 2:30.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Schultz, and I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is a part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And to my left is Jerry Manahan. He's the deputy administrator. And we're here to provide information about and to request the committee's support for Senate Bill 233A. This bill amends the workers' compensation statute in three areas: employer coverage, so-called non-complying employer claims, and then self-insurance security. And I'll cover these for you, and obviously be glad to answer any questions you have on the bill. First, in the area of employer coverage, insurers must file guarantee contracts for all of their insured employers with the Workers' Compensation Division for the workers' compensation coverage. Within 30 days after the division receives notice of the contract termination, this bill will do some cleanup of that process. It's going to allow insurers to establish coverage with their employers by electronic means, so that they can transmit electronic data from their computer portals to ours. This bill will also eliminate some unnecessary notice requirements that are in the law today. And it also is going to mean that when the insurer terminates liability upon proper notification by the employer, that this bill will allow that to go forward. We are in the process of transferring from a paper-based system where insurers report that employers have purchased coverage for workers' compensation to an electronic filing system. This bill will improve the division's internal processing, and will also eliminate situations where employers are deemed non-complying, which means that employers are found not to be in compliance with their requirement to have workers' compensation insurance when they have a workers' compensation policy in force, but the insurer has failed to notify the division by filing the guarantee contract requirement. Currently, today, under the law, if the insurer fails to notify the division with the guarantee contract, our only recourse is to hold that employer in non-compliance when they have very well have bought their insurance directly from the insurer. This bill does deal with non-compliant employer claims and how that's handled. Unfortunately, we do have situations here in Oregon where employers have failed to purchase the mandatory workers' compensation insurance, and when a worker is injured, then there's claim filed, and it's what we then call a non-compliant employer claim. Currently, workers are declared when a worker is declared as not subject, and what that means, they're not subject to the workers' compensation coverage laws. The worker has 30 days to appeal that finding from the date that the agency mails that order to the worker. On the other hand, when an employer is declared non-complying, the employer has 60 days from the date of actual service of that order to appeal. What we want to do is basically level the playing field here, and 233A will establish equal appeal rights for workers and employers both at 60 days from the mailing date from the division, and it will allow the agency to serve all orders at the party's last known address. And that's important to us because there, on occasion, a non-compliant employer is served with notice, and they see this envelope come into their post office box from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and it's got that green card attached to it, and they recognize what they're getting, and frankly, they just don't pick it up, and they have that option not to do that. And so, under the law, then, we have not served the employer the notice. What this bill will do is allow us to establish that we've served the employers by the mailing of that order and give the employer 60 days to appeal from that mailing date. This bill also is designed to improve efficiency by eliminating a requirement that the legal counsel that's used by the assigned claims agent who processes those non-compliant employer claims has to have their legal counsel designated as special assistant attorney generals. The one exception to that in this bill would be Safe Corporation. If Safe Corporation is the assigned claims agent, then as a quasi-state agency, their legal counsel would still be required to be special assistant attorney generals. Now, this provision is in this bill at the request of the Department of Justice. The division would save costs of approximately $1,000 a month that we are paying Department of Justice to provide oversight for those special assistant attorney generals. And again, they agree completely and in fact requested that this be part of the bill. A third area with non-compliant employers that this bill would do would be to eliminate a nuisance penalty that we are required to serve under the law to non-compliant employers. If you are found to be a non-compliant employer, it's an expensive finding. The average penalty for being found as a non-compliant employer is over $11,000. for that employer. In addition, they have to pay the claims costs plus processing costs on those claims. Most of that penalty is served up front. There's an order finding the employer is a non-compliant employer, and that penalty is served very early in the process in the claim. But the law also contains a subsequent penalty that makes up less than 1% of the total penalty that's assessed, and it's assessed at the time that the workers' compensation claim closes. This penalty further punishes employers at that time, and certainly was put into the law to discourage employers from being non-compliant employers. But the fact of the matter is who that punishes are the employers who are still in business, and frankly the ones who have gone out, gotten insurance, and are trying to cooperate with the division. By eliminating this penalty, we think we can focus our efforts on investigating current employer coverage problems. The cost of administering this penalty is higher than what we bring in from collecting that penalty. And I personally like to refer to this penalty as the rubbing salt in the wound penalty, because the non-compliant employer has already paid 99% of the penalty that they're required to pay. The claim is processed, the claim goes to closure, and voila, we come along and hit them again with another penalty at that time. And this bill would eliminate that penalty. Another area that this bill would amend is in the area of self-insurance security. Under existing law, self-insured employers must have a security deposit with the director to pay injured worker benefits in case the self-insured employer defaults or goes into bankruptcy. The courts have ruled that money or cash or government securities are not secure in a bankruptcy court. What we want to do in this bill is eliminate the current reference in the statute that forms a security that self-insured employers can post be cash, government securities, or other forms of surety the director decides by rule. What this bill would do would be to clarify that the security requirement would be developed by rule by the director. We worked closely with the Oregon Self-Insured Association on this change, and they are perfectly comfortable with this change. This amendment would change the security requirement so that it would only apply to security deposits that are established on or after the effective date of this act. What this means is that it will allow the self-insured employers to maintain their existing forms of security until those securities mature and need to be replaced. At that time, any replacement security or any new security that would need to be obtained by the self-insured employer would be in the form specified by the director in rule. New self-insured employers or anybody required to increase their security deposits would need to obtain the new or additional security as specified by rule. Also in the area of self-insurance, SB 233A will establish joint and several liability for each entity in a self-insurance certification so that subsidiaries of a self-insured employer cannot terminate their self-insurance and leave their claim liabilities with the parent company. In summary, these changes that are proposed in SB 233A are designed to improve and streamline regulation of employer coverage requirements in workers' compensation. This bill received full support of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. It received full support of the Senate Business and Labor Committee. We are unaware of any opposition to this bill, and we respectfully request that the committee support Senate Bill 233A and send the bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Monahan, you didn't have any testimony, did you?
Mr. Chair, I'm here to answer questions if you have any technical questions.
Okay, any questions? Okay, thank you for your testimony. And we'll close the public hearing on House for Senate Bill 233. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 233. Mr. Forrest?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 233A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved Senate Bill 233A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, we'll call the roll.
Representative Backman.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative
Close. Oh, excused.
Representative
Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Mullins
Anderson.
Aye.
Representative
Berger.
Aye.
Chair
Doyle. Chair votes aye, and I'd like to move this to the consent calendar. Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And that closes the work session on Senate Bill 233A, and we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 3. Judy Brown.
Chair Doyle and committee members, I'm Judy Brown from Carlton. I'm the grandmother of a 14-year-old mainstream deaf child born deaf. And I am also affiliated with the Alexander Graham Bell Association for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing here in Oregon. I thank you for this opportunity to be here today. Children like my granddaughter are increasingly being placed in mainstream classrooms with their hearing peers. My Carrie is the only deaf child in our Carlton school, and their being there poses a challenge for the teachers and for the administrators when educational opportunity is not available for these children. It's come to my attention through my experience with Carrie that non-captioned media just leaves her out, and research has proven that she isn't alone. There are really many thousands of deaf and hard of hearing children in mainstream classrooms who are being excluded because of the lack of captioned media. The law that the Federal Communications Commission passed back in 96 does not address educational media. In fact, I've encountered folks who have indicated that they didn't really think about the children in our schools. They thought about captioned media as being important for older people, you know, with the TV shows and such. So I guess the thrust of it is that I'm trying to raise awareness and just let folks know that this is a problem area that's recognized by professionals in the field. This will also help, captioned media would also help children who are learning English as a second language and who are learning disabled. We have the support of educational professionals behind that. It would also be beneficial for just a regular student in a classroom. During the last session, Oregon legislature passed SJR 28, which was addressing educational videos, captioning educational videos. That was carried by the OSBA onto the National School Boards Association, where it was also approved. And I was so encouraged by that because it just shows that once it's brought to folks' attention, they are supportive of trying to get something done about it. This will just raise awareness at the congressional level. There's no mandate, or we're just letting them know that Oregonians recognize there's a need here, and I respectfully request that you all send it on to the floor of the House.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions? I'll be happy to answer them.
Any questions?
Comment.
Sure. Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you. I want to thank you for bringing this forward. My sister was born deaf. My mom had the rubella, or had the measles, and so she was born deaf. And she went to an oral school and learned how to lip read.
My grandmother's father.
And then went to school with me, 7th and 8th grade, and there was nothing like what they have nowadays. And I like watching TV with the sound off and read the captioning myself. I think it's a good idea. There are many, many, many people in this world that are deaf.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Thank you for your testimony. No others to testify, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 3, and we will open up a work session on SJM 3. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Joint Memorial 3 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved SJM 3 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative
Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Burgess.
Aye.
Representative Doyle. Chair votes aye, and Representative Moss Anderson will carry this bill. That closes the work session on SJM 3. And colleagues, we are going to stand at ease for about 5 minutes and wait for Senator Brown to be here about 1:30. We'll reopen our Committee on Rules and Public Affairs, and we will open up a public hearing on SJM 5. Senator Brown.
Hi, Mr. Chair. Welcome. For the record, State Senator Kate Brown representing Senate District 21, Northeast Portland, just a little bit, Southeast Portland, a lot, and the City of Milwaukee. Thanks so much for hearing SJM 5. This is a collaborative effort that grew out of my role as Vice Chair of CSG West, and I heard this presentation this summer. A number of the states are considering this particular initiative. You do have in front of you a fairly large, thick document, which I won't go through in its entirety, but basically there's some pretty wonderful visuals about what's happening in Western states versus other states. Basically, Western states are falling behind in education funding when measured in growth of real per pupil expenditures from 1979 to 1998. For example, 11 of the 12 states with the lowest real growth in per pupil expenditures are Western states. Despite the fact that Western states tax at a comparable rate and allocate as much of their budgets to public education, Western states nevertheless have higher per pupil teacher ratios and lower real growth in per pupil expenditures. On the average, the 13 Western states have 3 more students per classroom than the 37 other states. So we're all wondering why this is happening. The problem lies with the federal government and the enormous amount of land it owns in Western states. For example, no state west of Montana has less than 27% of its land federally owned. That's not counting Hawaii. This basically affects our Western states' ability to fund public education in a number of ways, and I believe the chair of the Education Committee, Representative Backlund, is fairly familiar with some of this. But number one, enabling acts. Most Western states' enabling acts promise 5% of the proceeds from the sale of federal land to the state for public education. However, the federal government has basically abandoned its policy to dispose of public lands. Secondly, property taxes. As you know, states cannot assess property taxes on federal lands. And obviously, public education depends heavily on state and local property tax revenues. In Oregon, it's estimated that we lose $175 million in annual property tax revenues. Three, school trust lands. At statehood, the federal government transferred ownership of specified parcels of land to the states as a trust for public education. Much of this trust land is difficult to administer and make productive. The federal government does provide payment in lieu of taxes since states cannot tax federal land. However, the amount of these payments to Western states in 2001 was only about 4% of the annual property tax revenue lost by Western states. So what does this mean for Oregon? Oregon loses $782 million in one-time revenue and $627 million in ongoing revenue on an annual basis. This measure, 627 million on an ongoing basis annually. So Senate Joint Memorial 5 asks for just compensation for Oregon from the federal government for the impact that federal ownership of land has an ability to fund public education. It also asks the government to provide an expedited land exchange process for land not intended for wilderness designation. And I think I can pull this out pretty quickly, but basically that's to prevent what we call the checkerboard effect in terms of federal and non-federal lands in much of our eastern Oregon. Let's see if that's fine. I would be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Moss Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think on page 26, the high percent of federal land ownership, our state has 52%, and only Alaska, Idaho, and Utah have more. So 52% of our land is not taxed at all. I mean, it's owned by the feds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, that's my understanding from the information that we have from CSG West. And I can show you on page 52, which is actually a picture of Utah, not of Oregon. But it talks about, you can actually visualize the checkerboard effect of federal land being owned next to private land and the impact that has. I know that Senator Atkinson was very interested in the memorial, particularly because of this provision. And, Mr. Chair, if I may, one of the questions that I got from my colleague, Senator Corcoran, was why bother? You know, the federal government is not going to listen. Well, I do think it's important that we sort of put red flags in front of our Western congressional delegation. When I was back in D.C. a few weeks ago, we met with our entire delegation and did raise this issue. I think it's also really important that we're working as a united front with all the other Western states. So I do think that we can have a much bigger impact if we're working with our colleagues.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a great measure. I'm real aware of some areas in my own district that are checkerboards where the sections owned in private ownership as timber farms are being very well managed. They're productive. They produce income and pay taxes. And the sections in between were planted 30 years ago by the federal government. Then abandoned, apparently. Nothing's happened. No income being produced, and no other values that I can tell. I mean, it's sort of desert land under the shade of the overcrowded trees. This bill, if I understand it correctly, I mean, this measure, if it were actually adopted by the federal government, would help take care of at least that piece of things, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes. And I do believe that our last forest fire season was in part due to the checkerboard effect and the inability of the Forest Service and other federal agencies to be able to manage some of these lands properly.
One other question, if I could, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to be very brief. Wouldn't this also improve forest management rather than having it being run out of Washington, D.C., if the productive lands were actually being managed by private owners or even public owners closer at hand?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's way beyond my land management skills. I think my husband would probably tell you yes. He works for the U.S. Forest Service.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you, Senator.
Thanks. Appreciate you hearing this measure.
Happy to do it. Just as a side note, when I was this summer, I was at the Toll Fellows Leadership Institute for CSG, and quite a strong Utah delegation there, including Representative Burkhart, who is one of those listed. And this was one of the topics of discussion we had, which indicated, you know, that it's very definitely a Western issue and something that we're proud to support. Okay, with that then, great. Appreciate your testimony. We'll close the public hearing on SJM 5 and open up a work session in SJM 5. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move SJM 5 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved SJM 5 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 And Chair votes aye, and we will have Representative Barnhart carry this to the floor.
Oh, I spoke too many times.
And we will close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Close the work session on SJM 5, and nothing further before the committee. We are adjourned.